recover completely? He'll likely have some memory loss, Dr. Park said. So much the better. I don't think we, Dr. Park began in a chiding tone, but the woman cut him off. It may well make him more manageable. Anyway, we'll give him enough to fill whatever hole is in his memory. Armo heard the woman walk slowly around, from his right side to his left, then back. You must admit, he's a nearly perfect specimen. Big, strong, and not overly bright. Armo frowned at that, but quickly resumed a blank, unconscious expression. I don't know about that, Colonel, Dr. Park said. According to his school record, he's a rather difficult character. Colonel Gwendolyn DeMarco, U.S. Army, laughed. Then I suppose it's a good thing he soon won't be quite human. Chapter 6. Hanging with Dead People. Shade knew she was being watched. She opened her eyes slowly, peeking at first, and seeing just what she expected. Gaia sat in the easy chair. Shade's heart pounded slow and heavy, a bass drum playing a dirge. Boom. Boom. She did not move her arms or head, perhaps could not move them, with dread running through her veins and arteries like a drug, like a poison. Only her eyes were hers to command, and she looked only at the girl. Gaia sat silent and still. The only movement was the slow dripping of blood that ran down her forehead to encircle her eyes, before pooling and then spilling down her cheeks. Blood tears. But then, Gaia's mouth began to move. It was as if she was chewing something too big to fit in her mouth. Her teeth bit, and then ripped at something Shade could not... And then she saw. It was the arm she had ripped from the first and only adult to enter the phase. It was the arm, and Shade could see it. Could see Gaia's teeth stripping blackened, crispy skin. The arm did not bleed, but blood drops fell from Gaia's face, and she grinned as she chewed, and grinned as she looked directly at Shade. And the arm? The arm was growing in length, even as Gaia tore the wriggling veins from the flesh. It grew and changed, and now there was a shoulder, a white, feminine shoulder, not a man's shoulder, a woman's shoulder, and now a neck. Chills raised goosebumps all over Shade's body, and a low moan formed in her throat, a moan she could not quite force out, a sound that wanted to escape but couldn't. No. 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 No! The arm had made a shoulder, the shoulder a neck, and now the hair, now the auburn hair, and an ear, and in that ear, the earring Shade had bought her mother on Mother's Day, and no! The sound came this time, a muffled cry, as if she were forcing it up through mud. Shade's whole body tingled, but it was no longer chills, but something strange and new, and... Gaia grinned and turned the partial carcass in her hand to face Shade, turned it slowly, slowly. An ear? A cheek? No! Suddenly Shade slammed into something hard. A second impact a second later as she fell onto her hip. She was awake. Gaia no longer sat in the easy chair. Awake. Shade breathed a shaky sigh of relief. It had been a nightmare. Then, she saw her legs and screamed. As had become Cruz's habit, she headed to Shade's house. It was a stunning day. One of those days you got in autumn in Chicagoland, when the sky was a perfect robin's egg blue, and the air was as crisp and clean as a hotel sheet, and the leaves were a carpet of gold and red beneath trees that would soon be outlined by snow or glistening with ice. Cruz paused once to write that down in her moleskin. Then she ran up the back stairs and knocked at Shade's kitchen door, which Shade opened instantly, as if she'd been lurking. What's up? Cruz said, and Shade held up a notebook. On the page in black block letters, house is bugged. At the same time, Shade said, Hi, Cruz, come on in, girl, we have homework to get done. Yes, Cruz said stiffly. Yes, we do. Shade led the way to the living room. She picked up a lamp and tilted it so Cruz could see the bottom of its weighted base. And there, where Shade had peeled back the felt, was something that looked a bit like a component stripped off a circuit board. Shade replaced the lamp and led the way to her father's study, a small book-crammed space between the main stairwell and the seldom-used parlor. She held up a hand, stopping Cruz. Then she pointed at a corner of the crown molding where there was what looked like a nail hole. She pointed at her eye, then up at the nail hole, and down at the direct line of sight to Professor Darby's computer. They backed out silently and tramped upstairs to the bedroom. And there was the next shock. Someone or something had beaten deep indentations into the top of the wall facing Shade's bed. And Shade's usually neat bed was tilted at an angle, with the front legs snapped in two. And her comforter had been ripped in half, so that the inner stuffing extruded. Yes, something odd had clearly happened. Cruz turned concerned, baffled eyes to Shade and saw on her friend's face a look of triumph. Shade jerked her head toward the bathroom, where she turned on the water and let it run loudly. I doubt they'll have put cameras or mics in my bathroom, or even my bedroom, but I don't want to take any chances. What happened? Cruz asked in a terse whisper. I did it. You did what? I ground up an ounce of the rock, made powder out of it, mixed it with peanut butter, and gagged it down. Oh my God, I thought you were waiting. You may not have noticed this about me, Shade said with unmistakable glee. But I am not patient. I took it, and nothing for hours. I was depressed. I couldn't believe it was all for nothing. Her words tumbled out in an excited rush, very unlike the Shade who Cruz had never seen overly excited or emotional. And? Cruz prompted. And I went to sleep. I had a nightmare, a bad one. And when I woke up, I was on the floor. The floor? Clear across the room, Shade said. She made a hand gesture representation of a person flying across the room and smashing into the wall. And she held her fingernails up for inspection. They looked as if they'd been digging in chalk. Or a plaster wall. Chills ran up Cruz's spine. In my nightmare, I leaped, Shade went on. I leaped, practically flew, and in reality, I leaped. 16.5 feet, I measured it. I leaped out of bed so fast, so hard, I ripped right through my comforter. The impact woke me up, Cruz, and I was on the floor. Jesus Christ, Cruz whispered. Half her mind was gibbering, oh my God, she did it, in a giddy, triumphant way, and the other half was thinking, oh my God, she did it, but in a very different tone. Cruz, I did it. It works. I have a power. What? But wait, what power? That we have to discover, Cruz. I can't believe it. I hoped, I wanted. It worked, Cruz. It worked. Congratulations? There was enough doubt in her voice to earn a sharp look from Shade, but Shade was not going to be put off. Do you know what this means? Shade asked. Practically jumping in place. Not really, Cruz admitted. It means the ASO works even without the dome. And that fact means that I was right. If bits of the ASOs are out in the world, and they almost certainly are, I won't be the only one. There will be other people with powers, Cruz. Some good, some not. But I will not be one of the random bystanders getting burned. I will... Shade stopped, and for a moment looked guilty. As though she'd said something she did not intend. I'll be able to do something. She finished lamely. About what? Cruz asked. I won't be one of the helpless bystanders, that's all, Shade said. She sat on the closed toilet, as if exhausted. For a while she said nothing. Then, with eyes cast down, as if she were inspecting the floor tile, she began to speak in a rushed, low voice, as if every word was distasteful. She was performing a duty, not unburdening herself. She shook her head slightly, as if denying what she was saying. You've seen the videos, Cruz, but I was there. People, kids, just this far away. Shade stretched her arm out and seemed to touch something in the air. And I heard her call me. Call my name. Cruz knew then. She knew as certainly as if Shade had told her. Cruz crossed herself slowly. Not warding off evil, but invoking God's attention to her damaged friend. Your mother, Cruz said. The muscles of Shade's jaw twitched. Her scars stood out white against reddening skin. A lot of people died there that day. Helpless, just innocent bystanders. She repeated the word and raised a finger as if she was a teacher making an important point. Helpless, Shade repeated, and the word was not self-pitying. It was not a plea. It was an angry accusation, and the accused was Shade herself. Cruz watched as Shade raised her hand to her scar, as she had done in the cornfield. Shade seemed self-conscious, knowing Cruz was watching, but was unable to stop herself from touching the tactile proof of her own weakness. Cruz wanted to ask, who was helpless? But the answer was obvious. Shade was helpless. Little 13-year-old Shade Darby had been helpless. It was madness, Shade said. The dome came down and the kids from inside were just running in panic, climbing over dead bodies, just... I told you that's how I got this. She pointed at the scar. Machete, I came close to dying. She sighed heavily, then tried to soften the tragic tone with a wry smile. I nearly died. And my mom did. Cruz wanted to take Shade's hand, wanted to hug her, but now the shark was back, and the human girl who had been helpless 4 years ago to stop the slaughter, to save her mother, had been pushed down and away. There was a distance to Shade now, a disconnect from her own emotions, and Cruz withdrew her tentative hand. It's not just powers she wants, Cruz realized. It's revenge. Revenge against a creature long dead. There's a strange mental side effect, though. Probably some reaction to the change. Wait, what change? Shade winced. It's weird, Cruz, but it did something to me physically. It was dark, so... But my legs? Fortunately, changing back is easy enough. Just form the picture of your real body in your mind, and... So what was the side effect? Cruz asked. There was... Well... It was weird, like a delayed nightmare after the main nightmare. It's hard to explain. Shade concentrated, eyes drifting up and away as people's eyes do when they're trying to recall something intangible. It was like... Remember that scene in Lord of the Rings when Gollum looked into the swamp and saw dead faces under the water staring up at him? You saw dead people? No, they weren't dead, and I don't think they were people. Shade avoided eye contact, glancing sideways suspiciously. Over her shoulder, as if she was anticipating someone sneaking up behind her. Just an extra nightmare, Cruz. Like I said, a holdover. I mean, I was asleep when the change started, but the important thing is, Cruz? It worked, Shade said. The normal Shade, Cruz's friend, reemerged, as if from a dark vision, and in a more enthusiastic voice said, I need to test it, work with it, somewhere private. Where I won't be exposed or accidentally hurt anyone. How could you hurt anyone? Shade held up her palms for inspection. Then she pulled up her sweatpants, pulling them up to over her knees. I hit that wall hard enough to knock divots into it, Cruz. Then fell 8 feet onto hardwood. And do you see a bruise or a scrape? Cruz did not. It's not just the ability to leap out of bed, Shade said. I must also be very strong and very, I don't know, invulnerable? Yes, maybe, Shade said, and bit at her thumbnail, dislodging some of the packed gypsum from the impact with wallboard. And then, as if drawn by magnetism, her finger touched her scar again. This is incredible, Shade, and scary as hell. But what's all this about bugs and cameras? Cruz whispered the words bugs and cameras. Ah, that. Shade dropped her hand to her side. After Iowa, the government team, you know, HSTF-66, must have started to suspect my father. I'm not surprised. In fact, I expected it. When I came home from school, I searched. There are probably other bugs I haven't found, but unless the task force wants to risk taking video of a minor girl in her bedroom or bathroom, I doubt there's a problem in either room. But how long have they been there? They could have heard everything. Shade shook her head. No. If they'd had surveillance on us earlier, they'd have stopped us before we went to Iowa. No, this is recent. This came after Iowa. what kind of person actually expects their house to be bugged? Cruz wondered, but said nothing. The answer was obvious. A person like the obsessed person in front of me. What do we do? Cruz asked. She was buying in, accepting the knowledge that Shade was not merely exploring possibilities or having a little adventure, but that Shade wanted power, and she wanted it for a revenge she could never hope to get. And yet, I'm going along. We do homework, Cruz. Down in the living room in plain view of any cameras. Then you go home. Tonight, I hop in the car and drive to Jewel Osco, where I pick you up and we go test this out. It was a bizarre day, to say the very least. The two girls hunched over books and laptops, scribbled and typed, doing work that no longer mattered to either of them, if it ever had, making stilted conversation for the benefit of listeners. Where's your dad? Cruz asked at one point. Kazakhstan, believe it or not. Cruz believed it. According to Shade, the next chunk of rock, ASO-4, was scheduled to land in a very inconvenient part of the world. Professor Darby was presumably there. Shade slid her a note, face down. Cruz palmed it and read it under the table they were using as a desk. I've got workmen coming to fix the wall before my dad gets back. Cruz made a wry expression that meant, of course you do, because you. Cruz left with a promise to be at Jewel Osco at 10 o'clock, after Shade had done the obligatory Skype with her grandmother, one of Martin Darby's attempts to provide adult supervision when he was away. Rain had come and gone while Cruz was in Shade's house, and as she set out for home, the trees dripped so energetically, it might as well have been raining. A left turn onto Dempster brought Cruz to the Starbucks above which her family lived in a two-bedroom apartment. As Cruz neared home, she began to alter her appearance, taking off a silver chain, sliding rings into pockets, turning her collar down, scuffing at the legs of her jeans until the cuffs lay flat. She was not denying who she was, not really, she told herself, just reducing the visible triggers that might cause a paternal eruption. It was an everyday decision for Cruz. How much to be herself, how much to risk, when to be bold, when to run scared. It was both automatic and exhausting. How am I presenting? How are people seeing me? She would say it didn't matter, but it was not so easy to take that whole don't give a damn attitude when there were people out there who would tease, bully, beat, even kill her for the crime of being interesting. And now I'm interesting, but with a friend who has superpowers, she muttered. She asked the sidewalk, what have I gotten myself into? She knew in her heart that no good would come from this. She knew deep down that she should flee, put miles between herself and Shade Darby. I should call the FBI. The thought percolated through her mind, enticing, oddly empowering. She could end this, end it now before worse things happened. But not before tonight, for sure. Not before she'd actually seen it with her own eyes. And then? Then was then. She would decide then. She ran the mental checklist, wondering just what would set her father off this time. Her father was not a violent man. She had no fear of his fists. His aggression took the form of sarcasm, slights, sneering looks he didn't bother to hide. It wasn't that his teasing or bullying was terribly clever or original. That would have at least showed some effort on his part. No, it was not that he was particularly good at being cruel. It was simply the fact that he was her father being cruel. My father. She could pretend that she didn't care what her father thought of her, but she could never really mean it. She would never stop caring. It would never not hurt. From that thought, of course, it was down and down in the spiral of shame, blaming herself, hating herself, hating the world for having done this to her. What kind of God would play this game? What kind of sick divinity would sit up in heaven and say, this one shall be all of the above. LOL. Cruz pictured God throwing back his great, bearded, cis male godhead and guffawing ha 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 and the angels snickering behind their hands. Cruz paused, pulled out her moleskin and wrote, God as bro, bro God. angels tried to expand his consciousness? It was maybe not a great premise for a short story or novel, but Cruise had learned to write down even the ideas that seemed dumb. Dumb now might trigger smart later. As she climbed the interior stairs that always smelled of coffee from the Starbucks, she heard an insistent, aggressive, whining voice and instantly knew her father had started drinking early. 5:20 in the evening, when he usually didn't get home until 6, or 8 if he stopped at a bar on his way. She took a deep breath, hesitating with her hand on the doorknob. She heard the first sound of an argument breaking out, a dish clattering in the sink, and then her mother's voice, pleading, weak, and self-pitying. Every night. Cruz hoped she could get past them to her room, her sanctuary, while they were distracted, so she pushed in, welcomed by the rich, earthy smell of mole warming on the stove. Her father was still in his work clothes, black work pants with muddy knees, a denim shirt with his name, Manny, in red on a white oval patch. He was not a big man, maybe 4 inches shorter than Cruz, with curling black hair and a brush mustache.
No overtime means you cut back, Maria. Not tomorrow, not some other day. Right the hell now. How stupid are you not to get that?
Manuel Manny Rojas said. Maria Rojas was first-generation Mexican, having crossed the Rio Grande on her father's back when she was 8. Manny Rojas was U.S.-born, second-generation, with parents from Chile. Cruz did not think her father ever spoke Spanish, and her mother rarely did, answering instead in heavily accented English.
I cannot take the steaks back, Maria muttered under her breath. I cannot take the steaks back. I can't, because I'm helpless.
Manny mocked her. Then he spotted Cruz.
Oh, good. Now this.
Cruz nodded at them both, tried to plaster on a bland smile, and kept moving, longing for the relative peace of her room. But her father followed, mincing behind her. Cruz felt her heart beating hard, a beat heavy with dread and sadness. She knew the next move, and sure enough, as she reached the door to her room, her father leaped ahead and ostentatiously opened her door, saying,
I'll get that door for you, miss.
Cruz stepped back and waited as he pushed the door open. She said not a word. Sometimes that worked, sometimes not. This was a not day.
You know, Hugo, if you really want to cut your dick off, I've got a pair of wire cutters that should do the trick.
He often said cruel things to her, laughing, as if to say, it's just a joke, lighten up. But this was a new low. Cruz knew she shouldn't let it get to her, but it did. Of course it did. Her father, despised her.
Why not just use a knife? Cruz asked,
wishing she sounded nonchalant and defiant, but knowing she sounded pathetic and weak and everything the man before her despised.
I could kill myself with a knife, which is what you want.
Shock registered on Manny's face at that, though whether it was shock that she had spoken back or shock at the realization that she was talking about suicide, she could not guess.
Excuse me,
Cruz said, and closed the door on him. She waited there, her room dark, hearing his breathing on the other side, half expecting him to push his way in and heap more abuse on her, hoping that he would knock and say he was sorry. Fat chance. After a while, he stomped off, and she sagged in relief, tears filling her eyes, feeling the wave of shame that came from knowing that he would now be just that much harder on her mother. It was in that moment of exquisite emotional agony, that moment of turmoil, that moment of slight and ineffectual resistance, that moment when the chasm of self-loathing once again opened beneath her, that it first occurred to Cruz. If it worked for shade. Out came the notebook. Cruz wrote, if it works for shade, why not me? Until that moment, that insidious thought had never, not even once, not even briefly, occurred to her. The Rock, ASO whatever, was all about shade, about her curiosity, her arrogant belief in herself, her desire to be more than she had been 4 years before, more than the 13-year-old girl blaming herself for her mother's death. So does that make shade the only person in the world who should have a power?
If it made sense for Shade to roll the dice without knowing what might come up, didn't it make equal sense for Cruz? She flopped onto her bed and grabbed the stuffed elephant she'd had since childhood and hugged it to her chest. I could have powers, and then let that bastard bully me. Let him try. But that fantasy was short-lived. Cruz had never wanted to hurt anyone, not even people who hurt her. She wanted just one thing in life, to be left alone to ask herself questions about who and what she was, to be able to carry out the experimental, delicate, personal work inside her own mind without the world demanding concrete answers and condemning whatever answer she came up with. It wasn't that she hated her male body, but it had never felt entirely like it belonged to her. She was sure that she wanted to try hormone treatments, but was not at all sure about surgery, not sure if that was the final answer. She wanted to explore the idea. Why should that be hard? Why should that be a problem for other people? How was it even any of their business? She pushed her stuffed animal aside and blocked out the sounds of the escalating parental argument by checking out new music on Reddit, thinking she'd find some things Shade might like. When she tired of that, she went back to work on the story she'd been writing for months, off and on, typing away on her laptop in fits and starts. The story was already too long and involved to be a short story, but she felt ridiculous thinking of herself writing a full-length novel. Anyway, the character she had created, the one who bore an almost embarrassing resemblance to herself, seemed dull compared to Shade. Her still new friendship with Shade Darby had warped her worldview. Shade's determination was more interesting than Cruz's ambivalence. Cruz admired Shade's self-control, her ability to step back and look at the world through coldly analytical eyes. She knew that she herself should do just that, take a big step back and think through what she was getting herself into. But it was hard, Cruz reflected, to concentrate when you could almost feel the pillars of normalcy crumbling beneath you. It was very hard to put words on paper when your imagination was busy picturing an entirely different reality. What powers had the kids inside the PBA acquired? She opened Wikipedia and found the list. Killing light, telekinesis, teleportation, the power to heal with a touch, to move at speeds that would amaze a cheetah, and a body made of rock, an arm like a boa constrictor, the power to make others see your own nightmare visions. Powers for good, powers for evil. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The old quote floated through her mind, trailing the counterpoint behind it. Yes, but if power corrupts evil people, then surely good people must have power too? When the alarm clock on her phone went off, she grabbed her bag and set out to meet Shade. Tiptoeing past her father, who was finally asleep in his chair with a football game on. Her mother asked in a weary voice where she was going and didn't bother to pay attention to Cruz's answering lie. Cruz walked around the corner onto Chicago Avenue and down the dark, cold street past the indifferent rushing cars of commuters to the bright lights of the Jewel Osco. Cruz waited by the parked grocery carts, ignoring the sneering looks of a couple ushering their little girl past as if Cruz was a disease carrier. The Subaru pulled in, right on time. You finish your paper? Shade asked as Cruz hopped in. I'll take an incomplete. Shade sighed, like a disapproving parent, shook her head, and said, Well, who knows? Maybe the world will grow up and will be very different than we expect, and all that education will be useless. Yeah, I was thinking that too. Maybe we'll be the ones to make the world different, Shade said with a significant glance. That glance made Cruz queasy. Look out, lights changing. Shade stepped on the gas and accelerated through the yellow light as an old bald man in a Mercedes leaned on his horn and showed them his middle finger. Where are we going? Cruz asked. To a very quiet place, Shade muttered. I borrow your confidence, Cruz thought. Do you know that, Shade Darby? Do you know that you're the shark, and I'm just the remora fish attached to you? Do you secretly despise me? They passed a gloomy gothic stone arch that marked the gate of the cemetery that divided Evanston and Chicago. They drove slowly down a side street into a quiet neighborhood of stone and brick Victorians that had mostly been converted to apartments or condos. The street ended in a cul-de-sac, where Shade parked.
Seriously? Cruz asked.
More than serious. Grave, Shade joked. They climbed out and pushed through an unlocked iron side gate. They walked silently down a path that brought them to the cemetery's perimeter, marked by a low brick wall, topped by a 3-foot-high chain-link fence. There was a hole in the wire, and they squeezed through.
How come you know about this hole in the fence?
Cruz asked suspiciously. My mother is here, Shade said in a flat tone that discouraged further questions. But still, Cruz saw her look away toward the east end of the cemetery and saw, too, the look of sadness that crossed her face like a shadow and then was duly suppressed.
My father, her mother, Cruz thought. Do we ever escape our parents?
There was no denying that the cemetery was a strange and spine-tingling place, quiet but for traffic sounds and the whine of a plane passing overhead on its approach to O'Hare. There were tombstones, mismatched, some humble, some quite grand, with impressive plinths supporting plaster angels and black-eyed saints, crosses, and the occasional Star of David or Muslim crescent. The cemetery formed a rectangle with rounded edges, one side facing Lakeshore Drive and Lake Michigan beyond. A main pathway bisected the cemetery lengthwise like a spine, with smaller paths extending like ribs. Trees that offered welcome shade on hot days were now sinister, looming creatures, bare branches silhouetted against the orange glow of the city lights to the south. The pitying faces of chipped and pitted stone Madonnas seemed to disapprove of both of them. Cruz crossed herself and intercepted an eye roll from Shade.
Hey, Cruz said, a graveyard at night is no place to go all atheist.
There's a quiet little area up here, Shade said. It was a spot where trees blocked most of the artificial light, a space with very old-looking tombstones. And when Cruz bent down to peer closely, she saw that at least one dated from the 19th century.
Okay, Shade announced, apparently unfazed by the gloom, and perhaps, unlike her friend, not tortured by memories of a dozen horror movie set in graveyards.
If a groundskeeper comes, I'll tell him we got lost looking for my mom's grave.
Yeah, and if the ground opens up and you see zombies, run. Now how do we do this?
I reread the Ellison book, the part about Sam Temple, when he first exhibited signs of developing a power. Her theory is that it was strong emotion, anger, whatever, that put him in touch with his power.
Okay, strong emotion, Cruz said, then with deliberate drawlery.
Strong emotion in you?
I have emotions, Shade protested weakly. I guess I don't
like them.
Is it because they make you feel vulnerable?
Of course, Shade agreed readily.
You know why men have all the power in this world, Cruz?
I'll tell you, because Homo sapiens is about 200,000 years old as a species. All of human civilization from like Ur of the Chaldees,
there's a blast from history lectures past,
Cruz interrupted, vaguely hoping to head off another round of Wikishade, but it was too late.
To the present day is not even 10,000 years, just 5% of that 200,000 years. 95% of human history was small bands, tribes living hand to mouth, hunting, picking berries, eating bugs. Longer, really, since earlier hominids. But anyway, little known fact, in primitive societies, women actually provided most of the food, but they also got pregnant. And it's hard to chase wildebeest when you're pregnant or nursing. It's hard to fight off the hyenas when you've got a baby in your arms. So that's what the men did. They had the larger muscles, and they kept the predators at bay and killed the occasional wildebeest for protein.
That's why I was probably never going to be a very good boy, Cruz said, teeth chattering from a combination of cold and nerves.
I never wanted to kill wildebeest.
Might be very tasty, Shade suggested. Anyway, hunting and fighting are what the men did, and they learned that they had to suppress their emotions, especially fear, in order to do it.
So,
You're trying to be male? This was said with a tone of irony, though Shade must have missed it. No, I'm just trying to win. Slap me. Hard. What? No! What are you talking about? Pain, Shade said. It creates emotion. You can't come up with a better way? Slap me. Do it. I do not want to... Oh, stop being such a wimp, Shade snarled. Pretend I'm one of those football players. Cruz realized Shade was provoking her, but even knowing that, her blood started to boil, just a little. The rage at her father that she had suppressed, but that did not wish to stay suppressed, was too raw, too recent, too near the surface. Come on, you wimpy, weak whap! Shade's head snapped sideways. She gasped in pain and surprise. Cruz gasped in horror at what she'd done. Part of me meant that slap, Cruz thought. Owa! Shade said, holding a palm to her face. You made me! Shade held up her hand, calling for silence. She was trying to channel the pain of the slap into, well, into doing whatever it was her sleeping mind had done the night before. For the next 10 minutes, they tried everything. Cruz twisted Shade's ear painfully. There was more slapping. There were hurled insults, which had the frustrating effect of giving them both the giggles. Cruz even launched into a sort of improvised ghost story. Anything to push Shade's emotional buttons, to cause a purely emotional reaction, and hopefully get her to act without thinking, to access the power the way, according to Astrid Ellison's book, Sam Temple, the original PBA power, had done. But Shade was simply not a person out of control. Shade was the living avatar of self-control. It's me, Shade said after endless attempts that had left her a bit bruised and very frustrated. I don't... She formed her hands into claws that seemed to scratch at the air, as if she was reaching for something, like she was trying to grab hold of something. Human feelings? I don't get emotional easily, she concluded lamely. You think? But Cruz was thinking that she knew how to evoke a reaction from Shade. But would it be too cruel? You blame yourself for your mother's death, Cruz blurted. Shade's eyes glittered in the dark. That's it, right? Cruz demanded. That's what this is all about. Shade had gone very still. The shark has doll's eyes. That won't work, Shade said at last, and her voice surprised Cruz. It was low and not at all angry. It was, to Cruz's amazement, a sad, defeated voice. She was looking for me, calling me. I didn't answer because I wanted to watch. It was exciting. I'd never imagined anything like it, so I didn't answer and she was looking for me. Cruz immediately switched directions. Sweetie, you were a kid acting like a kid. You can't blame yourself for her death. Sure I can, Shade said flatly. She turned toward her mother's grave. Not 100%, maybe not even 50%, but some percent. Some percent greater than zero. I never lie to myself, Cruz. I don't mind lying to other people, but I don't lie to myself. I know I am doing this. I know it's guilt and revenge, but it's also curiosity, same as it was then. I want to know, Cruz. I want to know what it's like to have power, real power, so you can stop trying to psychoanalyze me. I'm not psychoanalyzing you, Cruz said. I'm kind of writing about you, I guess, at least in my head, so I'm trying to understand. Shade turned to her, head tilted skeptically, almost mocking. I'm not hard to figure out. You're hard to figure out. You haven't figured yourself out yet, Cruz. Cruz took Shade's hand, and to her surprise, Shade squeezed her hand back. Hello, ladies. The voice sent adrenaline flooding into Cruz's veins. Shade and Cruz turned and saw two guys who were clearly not there for innocent reasons. Cruz's hand drifted to her phone. Could she call 911 before the guys started in? Or would an attempt at a phone call just be the signal to start the beating Cruz knew must be coming? Shade, too, felt the rush of adrenaline, but her mind was crystal clear. She saw two white men in their late teens or early 20s. Neither was in a uniform, Therefore, they were not cops. They were also not random street people. No overloaded shopping carts or dirty overcoats. The one on the right had a club of some sort stuck in the back of his pants, but the one on the left was dominant. Their stances revealed this. So, if the one on the right had a club, the dominant one likely had something worse. Maybe a gun. The balance of power was impossible. Two strong, young, likely armed men versus Cruz in shade. Not a winning formula. At least not to Cruz, whose heart sank into her stomach. But a quick glance at Shade revealed a small, tight smile. "Good evening," Shade said. "Good evening to you, m'lady," the one on the left said. He had sunglasses perched atop his head, despite it being night, so they were not a mere possession. They were either a fashion statement, or perhaps booty from some earlier robbery. "Kind of late for a lovely lady and a big old homo to be hanging around a graveyard." "We came to visit a grave," Shade said calmly. "Yeah? This grave?" Sunglasses pointed to the nearest headstone with his toe. The headstone read, "Joseph Crouch, beloved husband," and below that the date, July 18th, 1902. "Yes," Shade said. Her chin was thrust forward, defiant. Cruz, however, was measuring distances, wondering how fast she could run and whether Shade could or would keep up. Sunglasses raised one booted foot, rested it against the headstone, and pushed. It did not fall over. "Jenks, give me that crowbar." So the club that they could not see earlier was a crowbar. To Cruz, this meant that they were indeed thieves, maybe even grave robbers. Her fear deepened. She had been beaten before, and she knew the damage cold steel could do. Her fear was visceral, very real, and it chilled her to the marrow. "I got it," Jenks said, digging the sharper end of the steel bar into the grass at the base of the headstone. "You boys must be new to the whole vandalism thing," Shade said. Cruz gasped, mouth open in astonishment. Cool and calm was great, but now Shade was provoking them. Sunglasses dropped the phony smile, and his face became a mask of malevolence. "Now give me the damn crowbar, Jenks." With the steel in his hand, he said, "I'll tell you what I can vandalize pretty well." "Man with weapon versus unarmed girl," Shade taunted. "That's about what a guy like you is capable of. Let me guess. No job, no girlfriend, no clue, no plan, so you're down to beat on people." "Well, I'll start with a beating, and we'll see where it goes." He stepped in and swung the crowbar sideways into Shade's arm. It should have broken the bone. It should have evoked a cry of pain. Instead, the steel bar bounced back, as if it had been struck against a spring. Cruz frowned at Shade's arm. Then, her gaze was drawn to Shade's face. Shade Darby's head was changing shape, narrowing, like her features were being squeezed into an invisible mold. Her eyes grew within a narrower visage, large, glittering, slanted, focused. Her lips thinned and her mouth was smaller. Her hair, the hair Cruz had so admired, was wrong, all wrong, not hair at all, really. It was drawn back into something like a series of spikes, drawn back sharply, as if lacquered, like some fantastic punk style, forming points and edges so sharp they might cut flesh. Shade blinked, and Cruz practically screamed, because for a moment a translucent membrane had come down over Shade's eyes. Snake's eyes. There came a low grinding sound, a wet, fleshy squishing, and Cruz stared in mounting horror as Shade's legs extended, grew, lengthened, until what stuck out from the cuff of her jeans was nothing even remotely human. The legs were long and brown and seemed to be made of rusted steel, and they ended in feet like no foot Cruz had ever seen. Shade's legs suddenly bent backward, the knees reversing direction. Her thighs swelled with muscle clad in dull armor the color of dried blood. In seconds, Shade was a terrifying hybrid creature, human mostly from the waist up, though a sleek, streamlined version of herself. From the waist down, she might have been some terrifying insect or great bird. Shade stood balanced easily on narrow, spiky claws. Altogether, she was several inches taller than normal, with her weight forward like a speed skater in motion, her face and hair looking as if they had been smeared back by a hurricane wind, her hair backswept into reddish spikes. Cruz gibbered in incoherent terror. Nonsense sounds, the urgent need to flee all but irresistible. And suddenly, Shade was gone. There was a sudden sharp gust of wind and a loud crack. Cruz heard the heavy sounds of bodies falling on grass, and to her amazement, the two punks were on their backs. The shade-not-shade creature stood vibrating between Cruz and the fallen men, vibrating like she'd grabbed a power line. A buzzing sound came from her, like a large mosquito.
Sorry, need to talk more slowly, I guess,
Shade said in a voice that sounded syrupy, like someone slowing the replay on an audio file.
I did it.
Cruz nodded, struck dumb, able to do nothing but stare. Shade had something in her hand, her relatively normal hand. It was the gun, the one Sunglasses had in his waistband. Cruz was about to tell her to throw it away when Shade did just that. She threw the gun in the direction of the lake. The gun should have flown 20 or 30 feet and landed on the grass between tombstones. Instead, there was a crack, and the gun, breaking the sound barrier, sailed over the tallest headstones, over the length of the graveyard, over Lakeshore Drive, and splashed in the water of Lake Michigan, a quarter mile away. The two vandals crawled off, yammering to each other in scared voices about crazy bitches. Shade, still vibrating, said,
I think I have super speed.
Yeah, Cruz said. Shade jumped straight up. She flew up and out of sight, a darkness against stars, then fell more slowly at gravity normal speed and landed hard, buckling her back-turned knees. She recovered quickly and said, jump, good, landing, not so much. Then Shade's new and unutterably disturbing form began to fade to normal. Cruz stared in fascination at the legs reversing direction again, at the feet becoming human feet once more. It was not as simple or as easy as a dissolve between two images. There was more movement, more twisting and shrinking and fleshing out. But finally, she was Shade again, a girl standing in ripped jeans. Shade retrieved her shoes, took a knee, and laced them up. Good, Shade said. I was worried I couldn't change back despite last night. That's a relief. Okay, that... Cruz began before realizing she had no descriptors big enough to cope with what she'd seen. It's amazing, Cruz, Shade said, but her tone did not mirror the words. She sounded wary, worried, which, Cruz thought, was the very mildest possible reaction to having your entire body transform. They got back to the fence and found it quite a bit harder to squeeze through with the jagged wire pointing at them rather than away. But when they finally pushed through, cursing small wounds, they saw that they were not alone. Shade sighed, shook her head ruefully, and said, Malik?
Yeah.
He was leaning against his car, a little two-seat BMW.
I sort of, followed you, he said.
You saw? She asked.
I saw something, he said. Something that should not be possible. Not even in a graveyard at night.
What the hell have you done, Shade? What the hell have you done? ASO-4 was scheduled to land in the mountains on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. An American SEAL team, launched secretly from a base in Kazakhstan, where Professor Martin Darby and a dozen others watched helmet cam feeds on monitors, raced to the impact site, hoping to get in, seize the meteorite, and get away before hostile tribesmen knew they were there. It was night, and the night belonged to the SEALs with their owl-eyed night vision equipment. Two helicopters landed while one stayed aloft, turning circles, its guns and missiles on a hair trigger, sensors scanning. Farther aloft floated a drone, flown by a pilot sitting 7,000 miles away at a console at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. Farther up still, two USAF F-16 jets, bristling with smart missiles, zoomed back and forth at near Mach 1 speeds. Some distance away flew the USAF airborne refueling tanker and the USAF E-3G, which watched everything with its array of electronics. And finally, 300 miles up, and well outside the atmosphere, a French satellite trained its cameras down and relayed its pictures to Paris, Langley, and the Pentagon. But all that technology was of no use in the end. A Kazakh interpreter had earned $200 and his life by giving advance warning to members of the Haqqani network, among the world's best-trained, best-disciplined terrorists. The Haqqanis had no notion of what was happening, just that a SEAL team was landing 2 miles away from a nameless village of 6 families, all devoted to raising goats and transporting opium. The Haqqanis had long since learned to be wary of American technology. They knew about the eyes in the sky. They knew that their heat signatures would be picked up. So they had arrived early and nestled deep in rock crevices, piling brush above themselves and driving a small flock of sheep and goats into the area to add to the signal confusion. The SEALs landed, leaped out, and formed a perimeter. They were the best-trained soldiers in any army, and the Haqqanis had a cautious respect for them, so they waited to see just what all this hubbub was about before starting a fight. From the second helicopter came different soldiers. These moved with far less liquid grace, and instead of automatic weapons, they carried instruments. The Haqqanis watched, puzzled, as these new arrivals walked back and forth in a grid pattern, before finally circling around a small patch of what, to the Haqqani's eyes, looked a bit like a bomb crater. Then out came a metal chest, carried by 2 soldiers, and the rest of the technicians busied themselves wrapping plastic around a particular rock about the size of a car tire. The Haqqani mission leader had seen enough. Whatever this rock was, it was worth a very big commitment of American and Allied resources. If the Americans wanted this particular rock that badly, then it must be worth something to a tribe that made its living off extortion, terror, opium, and hostage-taking. Rifle and machine gun fire opened up in the night, arcing toward the SEALs, killing one instantly and wounding another. Rocket-propelled grenades flew, trailing sparks and smoke, and slammed into one of the 2 parked helicopters. The SEALs began an orderly, disciplined withdrawal, but the technicians either dropped to the ground or fled for the helicopter. Now it was a melee, a firefight, with Haqqani shooting down and SEALs shooting at targets they couldn't really see. It was quickly clear that the SEALs could not hope to hold on, and they withdrew by stages to the surviving helicopter, 2 of their number struggling to drag the heavy chest and its rock cargo. The drone found a target and sent a rocket into the dark rocks, blowing one of the Haqqanis apart and injuring another. The helicopter was hovering now, just a foot off the ground, as the men with the chest covered the last, desperate few yards. And then, a sharpshooter's bullet took off the side of one man's face. He fell, and a fellow SEAL jumped down from the helicopter, threw the wounded man over his shoulder, and slung him into the helicopter door as an RPG round barely missed, pelting the beating rotors with noisy shrapnel, sending sparks flying. The SEAL's helicopter rose, turned, and roared away. The chest and the rocket contained remained behind. The Haqqani leader knew he had minutes, maybe just seconds, before the jets blasted the area and annihilated every living thing. He sent 3 of his best men at a run to seize the chest. Sure enough, the F-16s fired their missiles, and the little dell exploded in fire and smoke. But by then the chest was in the entrance to a shallow cave, and the Haqqani battle chief was frowning down at what looked like nothing but a rock. He had lost 3 men, leaving 3 widows and 5 orphans. And it began to occur to him that if this really was just a rock, he was going to have some explaining to do. Chapter 7, An Unhappy Guinea Pig. There was a quick stop at Decca's apartment to grab a few things and her black and white cat, Edith Windsor, E for short. With the FBI man Carlson watching, Decca threw a few shirts, some underwear, and socks into a duffel bag. The cat went into a plastic cat carrier. "Anything else?" Carlson asked. Decca stood in the center of her living room. The tiny kitchen was separated only by a counter. The bedroom door stood open, and Decca wondered if she should make the bed before leaving,
There was a sense of permanence about this departure, not necessarily as if she'd never see the apartment again, but rather as if this were the closing scene of the last 4 years of her life. Only now did Deka see that those last 4 years had been a dream, unreal somehow. The phase was real. This life, this depressing apartment, her crappy job, the stack of unpayable bills on the coffee table, her barely there social life with her dull friends, her nearly non-existent love life, all of it a gray, badly lit, poorly photographed home movie that no one wanted to watch, least of all her. And what was next for her?
Back to the phase, she muttered.
Didn't hear you, what? Agent Carlson asked. Deka shook her head.
One more thing.
She took her framed picture of Brianna, the one Brianna's parents had given her, wrapped it in t-shirts, and packed it away in her bag. Deka and her cat were sent off in a convoy of black SUVs to the south, down the 101 through the brightly lit streets of San Francisco, down the Pacific Coast Highway, past Monterey and Carmel. They left the PCH and headed east along ever narrower roads into rugged, wooded hills with night closing in all around. They reached a high chain-link gate with a guardhouse and three uniformed security types with machine pistols slung. Their IDs were checked, flashlights blinding Deka as she produced her driver's license. Once they were through the gate, the road paving was dramatically better, smooth as butter. It curved up and east, up and east, until they crested a hill, and Deka saw what might have been an isolated high school or a minimum security prison. Half a dozen two-story buildings, painted tan and marked with stenciled numbers. Stadium lights turned the whole place eerily bright. "It's a Defense Department facility," Tom Peaks narrated. "They used to do research on radiation back in the 50s when it was built. It has an official designation, but everyone calls it Hidden Valley Ranch. You know, like the salad dressing. Or just the ranch."
"It's not Defense Department anymore," Deka said. "Those weren't military police. They were private security."
Peaks nodded and smiled, as if he was the proud teacher of a student who'd said something clever in class. "Very good. Yes, it is no longer technically DOD. It's now run by Homeland Security, specifically HSTF 66, a designation you may hear from time to time. But don't worry, it is all very secure and very well guarded. Fences, electric sensors, cameras. And those guards may be contract help, but they're all former MPs or other ex-military. You'll be quite safe."
And quite trapped, Deka thought, which was probably your point.
The convoy parked, and Peek showed Deka into one of the buildings, a charmless two-story elongated rectangle that must once have been an army barracks, building 104, according to the stenciled number. They climbed stairs, Deka banging her cat carrier, while Peek's helpfully shouldered her bag, to reach a doorway halfway down a gloomy hallway. Inside was a small one-bedroom apartment, with a kitchenette and, oddly, a grand piano that filled a third of the main room.
"I don't play," Deka said.
"Oh, that. Yes, we had a Romanian gentleman staying here, a concert pianist. You're welcome to tinkle away. You have no immediate neighbors."
"Swell."
Deka set Edith Windsor down and turned to Peaks, anxious to get rid of him and use the bathroom.
"Food?"
"You'll find everything you need," Peaks said. "Get a good night's sleep. I'll send someone for you at 7 a.m.
"The hell you will. I'll go at 9 a.m. and that's my best offer."
Peek smiled and nodded. "Fair enough." He left, pulling the door behind him. Deka stood in the silent room, so like a bargain hotel, she thought. One of those places with the word suites in the name. She tested the door. It was not locked, which was reassuring. She raised the blinds and looked out on a view of bulky air conditioning units and a bit of parking lot, which frankly was no worse than her own apartment's view of a dumpster and part of a smaller, dimmer parking lot. In the cupboards, they'd stocked E's favorite cat food, along with snack foods that were suspiciously familiar. They were making no effort to hide the fact that they had spied on her and entered her apartment to gather information. They even had the Pete Sumatra coffee Decca liked, but usually could not afford. There was a small but new refrigerator with milk, sliced honeydew melon, sliced cheddar cheese, Genoa salami, Sierra Nevada pale ale. My God, Decca thought. They've even stocked the freezer with Ben and Jerry's half-baked. It was as if they'd moved her own refrigerator to this new place, minus the spilled maraschino cherry juice and the withered carrots. Decca fed E, who stared balefully at the food, then stalked off to find, yes, there was a cat box with fresh litter. Of course there was. Peeks and his people had thought of everything. Decca unpacked her duffel bag and regretted that she forgot to pack her favorite ratty chenille robe, but in the closet, there was a brand new version of it hanging. Okay, then, Decca said. She popped open a beer and drank half of it in one long swig. Wi-Fi? She opened her laptop and waited while it searched for a Wi-Fi signal. It found one labeled Guest DT, which was not password protected. She signed on with no trouble, checked a few favorite sites, and then opened her email and typed, I am being held prisoner by DARPA. She typed her own email address at the destination, then hit send. She was not surprised when the email sat spinning in her out tray for a long while before the system gave up and suggested she try again later. Uh-huh, later. Right. She had internet access but could not email and was fairly certain she could not text, DM, or even leave a blog comment. She was connected but cut off, able to see but not speak. She tested her Netflix and iTunes accounts. Both worked fine. Then she tested her ability to upvote a post on Reddit, and once again, nope. Download, yes. Upload, no. She considered looking for the cameras. They had no doubt installed in the little apartment, but this was a DARPA facility, and this apartment was obviously built to hold people under observation, so Decca accepted the reality that she would likely never find their surveillance equipment. Instead, she pushed back from her laptop, stood in the center of the room, and said, Fine for now, but where's a thermostat? It's hot in here, and I need to know my bike is safe. There was no answer for a long minute. Then a voice that came from, well, everywhere, said, Climate control is on the wall to the left of the closet. Your motorcycle is safe in the main lot with the cover on. Thanks, very godfather, Decca said. She showered. They had her favorite brand of shampoo, not the cheap stuff she usually bought, but the nice stuff she occasionally got discounted or damaged from work. She dried with very nice towels, put on the robe. It was identical to hers, except for the lack of chocolate stains and the hole she'd burned with a dropped joint. She had another beer and considered. Normally she might talk to the cat, but not with people listening. Not the worst situation I've ever been in. Not by a long shot. And that thought called up a wave of memories, some still so raw after 4 years that she had to squeeze her eyes shut and search for safer territory. Free rent, free beer, Netflix works. But of course, she knew this was not the whole of it. She was a lab rat, she supposed, some kind of experiment. After all, DARPA was all about research, wasn't it? Super smart scientists all beavering away, looking for new and exciting ways to kill America's enemies. I'm a lab rat, but I'm a lab rat with 2 pints of half-baked. 10 minutes later, there was only 1 pint of half-baked, and between the hot shower and the long drive and the stress of uncertainty, along with a degree of excitement, she had to admit. Decca got sleepy. She took from her bag the one personal item she'd brought, propped her picture of Brianna on the nightstand, and fell asleep. The next morning, the fun began. Decca endured hours of psychological tests, followed by part of an afternoon of physical tests, with mounting impatience. Patience had never been Decca's thing, before finally calling an irritated stop. We're done, Decca said. Actually, the medical tech said, we still have, and yet we are done. But we, hey, listen to me. Listen to the words coming out of my mouth. There was a voice that Decca could access when necessary. It was her "don't screw with me" voice. It was not the voice of a 19-year-old young woman. It was the voice of a person who had survived hell and was impressed by absolutely no one. "We are done. So pull the damn needle out of my arm." The tech pulled the needle out and slapped on a bandage. "Thanks." Tom Peaks appeared, as she suspected he would. "So, are you all finished up here?" he asked brightly. "Can we not waste time pretending that you don't have me under surveillance every minute of the day?" Peaks emitted a snort that might have been a laugh. "All right, let's do that. Good. What happens next is that you tell me what all this is about." It was not a question or a suggestion. It was her precondition for going forward. Peaks jerked his head toward the door. "Join me for a cup of coffee?" He led her down the stairs, down below ground level, to a long hallway that led to another long hallway. It was a corridor kind of place. The ranch. More of it underground than above. Finally, they arrived at a set of stairs that they climbed to reach a mostly depopulated cafeteria. Peaks fetched coffee, and they sat at a table beside a window that opened onto an interior courtyard. There was a small knot of people in the courtyard smoking, and Decca felt the inner tug of the reformed ex-smoker. She had smoked for almost 2 years after escaping the phase, and quitting had not been easy. Not even a little bit. Peaks laid his briefcase on the table, slid his laptop out, and opened it so she could see the screen. Peaks then came around the table to sit beside her. He tapped keys, and a YouTube video opened. Decca instantly recognized the freeze frame. "I've seen it. Let's watch it again." The video was poor quality. A fixed camera, obviously a surveillance camera, showing the bright interior of a 7-Eleven. And they were looking down at rows of food and a cold case beyond, stocked with beer and bottled water. And suddenly, there was what looked like a girl. The girl just appeared, considering the potato chips. She was unusual in the extreme. Her skin appeared to be gold, like the doomed woman in the old James Bond movie Goldfinger. Her hair was black, but looked less like thousands of small strands and more like a sort of flexible plastic. The girl moved in the blink of an eye to the magazine section. She grabbed 3 celebrity gossip magazines and was suddenly, simply, gone. "Like I said, I've seen it." "You know who it is?" Decca shrugged. "It looks like Taylor, who is one of the kids from the phase. She could teleport. And she was unaccounted for after the barrier came down," Peaks said. He was sitting beside her, so that she had to turn to meet his steady gaze with her own. Taylor was a malicious little gossip and troublemaker. "Taylor was, past tense," Decca said. "She used to be a girl, a normal-looking girl, kind of pretty, really. She had the power of teleportation, and sometimes she was actually helpful. But toward the end, something happened that turned her into, I don't even know, some kind of weird gold Play-Doh creature who had powers, still has powers, even now, even long after the dome came down. That video is just 6 months old. Looks like..." Decca drawled, refusing to speculate further. She'd always assumed the tape was a clever fake. "Any idea why she didn't take food but did take magazines?" Decca shrugged. "She doesn't eat, didn't eat, not after she, you know, became that. And she always was a superficial little ninny, so gossip rags would be about right." To Decca's relief, Peaks didn't press it further. She'd been avoiding thinking about it, preferring to believe it was all some fake. Her relief was short-lived. "Now," Peaks said, "I want to show you something you have not seen on YouTube because we've got the only copy." He tapped the keyboard, and a window with the logo of the NSA, the National Security Agency, came up. More tapping, a password, and then a view window. It was an aerial shot and looked like it had been taken from hundreds of feet above. "Drone?" Decca asked. Peaks did not answer. And then something came into view. A person. Decca saw the top of his head, his shoulders, the tips of his toes as he walked. Then,
Jesus! Decca was on her feet, her chair knocked over, her whole body electric, tingling.
It's a bit hard to make out, Peek said laconically, playing it cool. You can see it much better in slow motion.
He pointed the mouse, and the video advanced more slowly. And there it was. There it was. The 10-foot-long tentacle that snapped like a bullwhip and snatched up what may have been a rat or a frog.
Decca stared and breathed hard. Speech was impossible. Her attitude of cool indifference was gone. Her eyes blazed.
I think we both know who that is, Peek said with sincere sympathy.
Drake.
Decca's voice was flat. She could barely breathe.
Drake Merwin, Peek nodded. A violent, sadistic psychopath, a rapist, a torturer, a murderer.
All that. Decca snarled, transfixed by the freeze frame Peek had left on screen.
Drake.
Brianna had chopped him into bits, and yet he lived. Sam Temple had watched him burn to ashes, and yet he lived.
Peeks closed the laptop.
More coffee?
You have beer?
Decca rasped, and her trembling hand twitched toward the cigarettes she no longer carried. An aide appeared out of nowhere, and Peeks sent him off to return moments later with 2 bottles of Sierra Nevada, apparently the official beer of the ranch, and 2 glasses.
I'm sure you can see why we are concerned,
Peeks said, pouring the foamy liquid for both of them.
He's a monster. I mean that.
She stabbed a finger down on the tabletop for emphasis.
A monster in body and mind.
Yes, Peeks agreed.
But that's not why we are worried. The problem both Taylor and Drake represent is this. They have somehow retained the powers they had in the PBA. The face, if you prefer. While people like you have not.
We think we know why.
Okay, why?
Both of them not only acquired powers, but somehow they've kept them. Kept them 4 years after the PBA came down.
Looks like, Decca said, clipped, tense, waiting.
They, unlike you, Decca, were physically altered. They were physically changed.